Good morning. 10:15 having arrived, I'm going to call this meeting of the Tax Committee to order for March 18th, 2025. The first item of business before us is to adopt the minutes for March 13th. Representative Norris, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
I have, Chair Gomez, and I move adoption of the March 13th minutes. And Chair Gomez is a newly minted voting member of the committee. I'm tempted to mark the occasion with a request for a roll call, but in the interest of time, I'll let us proceed with a voice vote.
Thank you for sparing us. Welcome back. Representative Norris is now a full voting member of the committee. We're happy to have him back from the gulag. All right, so we have a motion before us to adopt the minutes from March 13th. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, no. Motion is adopted. The minutes for March 13th, are adopted. A couple things before we get into the two bills that we have before us today. First is Ms. Abraha, do you just want to say hi? We have two CLAs in our committee, and one of them didn't get to say hello. So just
hello, everyone. My name is Shamada Braha, and I'm the DFL-CLA for this committee.
Wonderful. Thank you. Do we have some pages here? All right. So if you wouldn't mind, if you could each stand up and say your name and who your state representative is and what the mascot for your high school is. We're just collecting general knowledge here in the tax committee, so we'd appreciate it. Whichever order. Okay, there we go. Do you want to start, and we'll go down the line?
Of course. So I'm Trevor. My state representative is Representative Cha from District 47B, and my mascot is a Spartan.
Wonderful. Spartan. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Tiffany Bordall. My state representative is Cal Warwas, and my mascot is Panther.
Great. Great.
Hi, everyone. My name is Kate Lee. My representative, Representative Kerr, and my school mascot is a blazer, but we often just have a chicken costume.
My name is Sonny Morales. My representative is Marty Fogelman, and my mascot is the Warriors.
My name is Daisy Sanders. My representative is Mickey. I don't believe this school has a mascot, but we do represent the parents.
Thank you. All right, couple no mascots. Thanks so much for being here, and we appreciate it, and I hope that your day goes well. All right, so the first bill before us today is House File 2274. I'm going to move that House File 2274 be laid over for possible inclusion in the tax omnibus bill. So this is basically, you know, last year we were able to get like four or five provisions from our 2024 tax bill into the final passed in the final agreement. But, you know, there's a lot that was left on the table. So we're kind of just rehearing the 2024 tax bill to get these provisions into the committee's jurisdiction for our negotiations at the end of the day. So we have two amendments. First, I'm going to move the A1 amendment. It's just a date change on the Woodbury sales tax construction exemption, which is Representative Cha's bill. I think one of his constituents is here. So all those in favor of adopting the A1, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? No. Motion carries. The A1 is adopted. And then we had to make a couple of kind of technical changes to align the language and the spreadsheet. And so that is the A2 amendment. Is there any discussion on the A2 since it's a little longer? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A2, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? No. Motion carries. The A2 is adopted. And House File 2274 is in the shape that the author wants it. Oh, I'm the author of the bill. I'm sorry, I forgot to mention that part at the beginning, but I'm just going to stay up here since that's what Chair Davids has done, you know. All right, so we're going to start by just, you know, it's kind of a lengthy bill. We're going to have nonpartisan walk through the components of the bill, and I think I'll just pass it over to Mr. Williams.
Chair Gomez and members, I think we're going to be working from this memorandum document that's in front of you that just sort of lists the origin of the different provisions in this bill. So I'm going to work through Article 1 here, which is individual income and corporate franchise taxes. This contains some changes that establish a electronic filing system for the political contribution refund. There's changes to the priority allocation deadline for the beginning farmer credit and some other technical changes to the beginning farmer credit. There's a bill that requires disclosure of certain information about corporations with $250 million of domestic sales. It contains language that was introduced this year in House File 30, establishing a direct free file system, so at the Department of Revenue. There's the language we heard earlier this session, Representative Norris's bill pertaining to coerced debt, discharges of indebtedness in situations of coercion. There's a bill, language moving 18-year-olds children or 18-year-olds from the older child credit in the Minnesota child credit to the younger child credit so that the per child amount is higher for younger children.
I'm sorry, Mr. Williams, could you just speak a little closer to the mic when the members is having
Sure thing.
Thank you.
There's changes to the Minnesota housing credit, so allowing a rollover of unused allocations in that credit. And then there's nonconformity to the Section 530 federal rules about employee classifications. That concludes the list of provisions in Article 1.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. We can take questions if you have questions now after each article, or we can save them. But if you have a question for nonpartisan staff, please just raise your hand. Without any questions, Mr. Swanson, do you want to walk through Article 2?
Madam Chair and members, Article 2 is the Property Taxes and Local Government Aids article. Section 1 of that article relates to the Alliance Housing Court decision, and this provision would clarify that charitable organizations, property owned by charitable organizations that is used exclusively for rental housing is not exempt. Sections 2, 9, and 10 contain the utility co-op attachments and appurtenances language that was heard earlier this year in committee. Sections 3 and 4 were also heard in this committee earlier this session, and they are the tribal-owned property exemptions. So Section 3 is the exemption for the five parcels in Cook County owned by the Grand Portage Band, and Section 4 is the exemption for the property in Minneapolis owned by the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. Section 5 relates to community land trusts, and it states that these properties must be valued. It removes the requirement that these properties be valued based on the normal approach to valuation. Sections 6 through 8, along with sections 11 through 17 and section 26, establish the advanced homestead credit for seniors, and this would allow certain seniors to receive an advance payment of their property tax refunds in the form of a property tax credit. Sections 18 through 21 contain the land bank economic development abatement language that was heard in this committee earlier this session. Section 22, 23, and 27 all relate to local homeless prevention aid. Section 22 would clarify that the aid cannot be used to clear encampments, and sections 23 and 27 would remove the sunset on the aid, which is set to expire after aid is paid in 2028. Section 24 is the aid penalty forgiveness for the city of Stewart that was heard earlier this session. And Section 25 creates a property tax exemption for taxes paid in 2021 and 2022 by the Red Lake Nation College. And Madam Chair, that concludes Article 2.
Thank you, Mr. Swanson. Are there any questions on Article 2? I didn't really mention this at the beginning, but some of these provisions have been introduced as freestanding bills and some have not, so it's sort of, we're just kind of doing a rehearing of the 2024 bill. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wondered why in that one section you're removing the sunset on local homelessness prevention aid. I thought, you know, in general we've had good discussions on keeping sunsets as a good governance practice, so I just wondered why you're taking that approach.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Representative Robbins. So you were here in the committee last term when we heard sort of about what our counties have been doing with the local homeless prevention aid. We do have a like kind of a part in statute where tax expenditures have 8-year sunsets. That decision was made about this, but local aids are not generally included in that 8-year sunset sort of that's a sunset requirement that's in statute for tax expenditures. And so, you know, this is removing the sunset on the local homeless prevention aid would allow our counties who have been, you know, really working hard across the state in to respond to the local needs around homelessness to continue that work. You're welcome. Thank you. Okay, is there any further, are there any further questions about Article 2? Seeing none, we'll move on to Article 3. Ms. Hagler.
excuse me. Madam Chair and members, Article 3 is the sales and use tax article. The first section is a provider credit provision that permanently establishes the rate of the research credit for the provider tax at its current rate of 0.5%. And I believe that had originally come from the governor's bill in 2024. Sections 2 through 5 relate to a newly established amusement device gross receipts tax that kind of swaps out the state sales and use tax for a new gross receipts tax on amusement devices. There was just a minor technical change from how it was in the 2024 bill. Sections 6 and 8 are similar to Representative Hansen's controlled substances tax repeal that the committee heard earlier this year. And Section 7 provides a construction sales tax exemption for projects in Woodbury with the amended date from the A1 amendment. And that concludes Article 3.
Thank you, Ms. Hagler. Are there any questions on Article 3? Yeah, Representative Robbins.
Sorry, Madam Chair.
No worries.
Just seeing the Woodbury construction exemption, will there be other construction exemptions and other elements of the bill? Because I know I have one for Maple Grove that I'd like to see included.
Yeah, thank you for the question. So on construction sales tax materials, there are dozens of them. And so Chair Davids and I have discussed this a little bit. It would probably take up several committee hearings if we were to hear each of them individually. So the way that the process works when we take things into conference committee is that if the topic is brought in, then the other, you know, if we bring a couple of construction sales tax materials into conference with us, they're all kind of in play. And as you know, the construction sales tax materials really comes down to a matter of money at the end of the day, and we know that it's help that our local governments need, and certainly we shouldn't take the fact that there are just a couple of them included in this as like that's the only ones that are in bounds for our eventual discussion. Representative Norris also is carrying a kind of blanket construction sales tax exemption, and so we may just be hearing that in the future, and then, you know, members could certainly, provide some comments about their individual projects. But I think just for the interest of time, we're probably not going to hear each one of them. Chair Davids, I don't know if you had anything you wanted to add.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I think you're very accurate in your comments that the thought might be to hear the Norris bill, which oversees the issue statewide. And, of course, the money thing might not allow us to do statewide, but then I think every one of them would be in play. So,
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Chair Davids as well. I appreciate that. I am in full support of the Norris bill if the money is available, but if not, I hope Maple Grove manages to survive. Thank you, members.
Wonderful. Noted. Thank you, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Gomez, and I apologize. Is this being, you know, a lot of these, I know it said it's been heard last year, but this is kind of overwhelming to me right now, and I don't know if this is the right time to ask this question. But is this normal in tax committee that if a previous omnibus doesn't go through, that we just push everything through where I see in other committees, bills are redrawn and rewritten, and then we hear them individually? Is this normal? Because it's kind of overwhelming to know what each one of these are.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Johnson. That makes a lot of sense that this would be kind of, you know, it's a lot of material to cover. And, I've been here for a few terms, so I'd have to defer to Chair Davids about whether, you know, this is kind of a normal practice. I've seen it a couple times. It's not something that happens every year. I would say I have seen, I believe it was a property tax division report that we kind of reheard in maybe, in 19, kind of in its entirety, or maybe 2020, just sort of stuff that had been undone from the previous year. It's been done in the, you know, chair rested in the Senate last year. But, you know, I guess I would ask Chair Davids for a little more historical perspective, because I can't really speak to its normalcy or not, because I've seen it a couple times. But.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Representative Johnson's question, I wouldn't call it normal, but this is the tax committee. We are trendsetters. And and I think it's useful that we're doing this, because it's early on. We've got time to look at these things, and then the committee will have to decide what's in and what's out. And so is it normal? No, but I think it's just fine that we're doing this to see what our DFL friends are proposing. And there's a lot more than DFL stuff in here. There's a lot of Republican stuff in here too. So I think it's good to go over this and see where we're at. And but it's not normal. But neither am I, so it's fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, I mean, us laying this over today certainly is the beginning of the conversation about these provisions, not the end. And so, you know, we'll be laying it over. If there is, you know, if we're moving along and you're like, hey, I want to bring this back up so that we can have a sort of more on-the-record discussion about this provision that I didn't see was in there before, we're happy to do that. We're definitely not trying to play any tricks on anybody. It's really just sort of trying to use our time efficiently, understanding there are a lot of provisions in here that if we heard them individually would take several hours of committee time, as it did last term. But Representative Johnson.
Okay, thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you, Representative Johnson. Okay, is there any, are there any further, oh yeah, just on the construction sales tax materials piece, we do the Brower, the Representative Wiener's Browerville piece was in our bill last year. It's structured in this case as a grant, but it's kind of in that same pot of we'll get to it in the miscellaneous section, but it's sort of in that same pot of construction sales tax exemptions that Representative Robbins was talking about. I don't see any other questions about Article 3. So we'll go on to Article 4, which is the tax increment financing article. All right, Ms. Hagler, you're handling that one too.
Madam Chair, yes, I'm just trying to avoid a chair shuffle here.
Great, thank you.
So Article 4, the TIF article, contained special legislation for the cities of Ramsey, Maple Grove, St. Paul, Brooklyn Center, Brooklyn Park, Eden Prairie, Edina, Minnetonka, Moorhead, Plymouth, and St. Cloud. And the majority of these are all as they were when the House bill left the floor, with a minor date update for the city of Ramsey to account for the one-year delay in having the bill heard. And I'll spare the committee from the details of each
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Hagler. If anybody has questions about the details of any of these specific tax increment financing projects, I'm sure that Ms. Hagler would be happy to answer them. And Representative, or Chair Davids.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. And this is an area I think there's a little more to it that we have to add to this, because there was a group that put together some ideas on how TIF districts should be done. And no, that's local option sales tax. I'm sorry. I'll wait till we get there.
Okay.
Okay.
Sounds good. And Chair Davids and I and our staff have had a little discussions about some of these areas. And we likely will be having at least a hearing or two on tax increment financing, because, you know, there are new projects that aren't included here. They are, you know, each project that comes forward is seeking a different exemption from state statute. And so, you know, we will be digging in a little more to this topic as we move forward. But if there are no further questions about Article 4, we'll go on to Article 5. I think that's yours too, Ms. Hagler. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, Article 5 is the special local taxes articles. It just contains four provisions. The sections 1 and 2 relate to the accommodations intermediaries local lodging tax provisions that would subject the full price of the amount paid for each lodging to the local lodging taxes in the taxing jurisdiction. And sections 3 and 4 relate to the downtown Minneapolis taxing area, where the rate of the food and beverage tax imposed in that area is reduced from 3% to 2.5%, and the area of the district is expanded to encompass more of the North Loop area. And Madam Chair and members, just also to note to Representative David's point, the local sales tax article is not here in this bill, so that was taken.
Chair Davids, did you want to add anything else on that article?
Well, I probably shouldn't speak to an article that's not before us, but when that does come up, I'll have some comments at that time.
Sounds good. Thank you, Chair. All right. Is there any other questions from the committee on Article 5, Special Local Taxes? Not seeing any. We'll move on to Article 6. I assume that's Mr. Swanson. Great. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, Article 6 is the miscellaneous article. Section 1 of Article 6 would allow qualifying veterans organizations to use up to 50% of the gross profits from charitable gambling for improvements to their properties. Sections 2 through 6 contain the land value taxation district language that was heard in committee earlier this year. Section 7 provides a $50,000 grant to the Anoka County Soil and Water Conservation District. Section 8 provides a $100,000 grant to the City of South St. Paul. Section 9 establishes an Emerald Ash Borer financial assistance program within the City of Minneapolis. Section 10 of Article 6 reappropriates $10 million to the City of Minneapolis that was included in the 2023 tax bill. And finally, Section 11 of Article 6 contains the grant to Browerville Public Schools that Chair Gomez mentioned a moment ago. And that concludes Article 6.
Thank you, Mr. Swanson. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's for you or Mr. Swanson. Could you tell us more about the reappropriation of the $10 million for the City of Minneapolis? What was it originally intended for, and what will it be used for now?
Yeah, I think I'll say a couple things, and then I'll turn it to Mr. Swanson to explain sort of the more technical parts of it. So this was included in the 2023 tax bill. $2 million of it was for a project in, it was a grant to Minneapolis. $2 million of it was for a project repurposing a former a warehouse, and $8 million was for assistance on the main commercial corridor that was impacted by the civil unrest following the murder of George Floyd. And the reason that we're still dealing with this is because we appropriated the money to, we sent the money to Deed. There was, they had to kind of contract it out to Minneapolis. There was endless delays in that. And as for like the reappropriation thing, I think I'll turn over to Mr. Swanson if you can explain kind of the sort of more technical part of it.
Madam Chair and Representative Robbins, the language in the bill would cancel the appropriation from the 2023 tax bill and then reappropriate that money again in fiscal year 2025. So I think the only thing I would add is that this is not an additional $10 million appropriation. The appropriation in this section would replace the appropriation from 2023.
And so just to add, there was basically the money for this was supposed to go out in 2023 and it didn't go out. The contract didn't get established until, I don't know, about 6 months ago, and then there's a date where the money cancels back to the general fund, but the delay in getting it out the door was really about this contracting process between Deed and the City of Minneapolis. And so if we stuck with the current timeline, it would mean that, you know, that money would have had to have been spent in a really short amount of time. And it is really designed to provide support and assistance to businesses that were impacted by the civil unrest and general corridor support. And, you know, kind of having them spend that amount of money in a very limited amount of time just doesn't really have the impact that it was originally intended to. But Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I'll hold my other questions for later. I'm reviewing the language right now, and I would say my caution in general in my new role is that Chair Pinto and I are soon sending a joint letter to everyone asking that we refrain from legislative directed grants as much as possible. And so I just wanted to flag that. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions on Article 6? Chair Davids.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Not on Article 6. I believe Representative Anderson has on.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I didn't see you. Representative okay. Anderson.
Thank you. There's a lot of us on this committee now. So yes. Just quickly, I can't remember the South St. Paul issue, the $100,000.
Yeah.
Refresh my...
Thank you. So last year, this was a bill, I believe, from Representative Hansen, and it was really to recognize the the challenges facing the city of South St. Paul with meeting their obligations to their residents, given some of the erosion of their tax base that happened with the some of the meat processing that plants that used to exist in the city and that industry unfortunately kind of left over many years, leaving them with a lot of land that was sort of off the property tax rolls. And so this was a grant to make up for that. Representative Anderson.
Thank you.
Great, thanks. Are there any other questions on Article 6? All right, seeing none, so there's a spreadsheet also. I think we won't have fiscal walk through it unless there are questions about it. Where they're happy to answer it, but if there isn't any objection. Chair Davids?
Well, thank you, Chair Gomez. Just a thought here on the Rep. Norris's bill on the sales tax statewide. I believe that's very similar to a bill that Representative Swedzinski had previously. I think they're pretty much the same because Representative Swedzinski had one. And the reason I think, Representative Swedzinski's bill was good. I think Representative Norris's bill is good because we have, I believe, and maybe a nonpartisan can help me out here, we have, I think, over 60 requests. Is that true?
Ms. Templin is nodding, but...
Madam Chair, Representative Davids, my count is over 50 plus sales tax construction bills.
Okay.
So, thank you, Chair Davids.
I think hopefully we can go down the route of the Norris bill, and then we'll just have to, as a committee, figure out, we'll have to put the puzzle together with how much we have for that, money we have for that area. So.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Davids. So before we go to general discussion of the bill, we'll move to testifiers. Thank you so much, Ms. Hagler, and to all of our nonpartisan staff for walking us through that. First up is Lars Negsted. Welcome to the committee. Thanks for being here. Please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Lars Negsted, and I serve as the policy director for ISAIAH. ISAIAH is a multiracial, statewide, nonpartisan coalition of faith communities and other community-based groups working toward racial and economic justice in Minnesota. I'm here today to speak in support of House File 2274, especially the provisions in Article 1 around corporate tax transparency and free direct filing. All Minnesotans deserve safe, decent housing, affordable care, and a future in which all can thrive. Because we are all interconnected, taxes are how we care for one another and meet our common needs. Yet, for too long, the wealthy few have used their outsized political influence to rig our tax system in their own favor and against poor and working class people. We see the results in skyrocketing inequality and rising corporate profits, while Minnesota children, families, workers, and patients continue to struggle to afford essentials like housing, health care, and child care. At the same time, giant corporations, whether they're based in Minnesota like United Health or Cargill, or other states like Amazon or Walmart, rake in billions of dollars in profits. Now, I have to offer a content warning as I'm about to use a phrase that I know can be triggering for certain chairs of this committee. With the lack of transparency, it's easy to see why so many people believe big corporations are not paying their fair share. You might ask, what do I mean by fair share? I think it's probably a good deal more than they are currently paying, but let's find out. If you pass the corporate tax disclosure provision in this bill, then we can get some data and have a good conversation about it. As to Section 5, free direct filing will make life easier for Minnesotans who will no longer have to pay big tax prep companies to do something that could be easy and free. Free direct filing has been successfully implemented in 25 other states from Florida to Washington, notably including our neighbors Wisconsin and South Dakota. It's time for Minnesota to catch up. We urge your support for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Negstead. Next up is Brian Cook. And Nan Madden, you're on deck. Welcome to the committee. Thanks for being here. Just introduce yourself and go ahead.
Thanks, Chair Gomez, members of the Taxes Committee. My name is Brian Cook. I'm the Director of Tax, Fiscal Policy, and Elections for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The Chamber is a statewide organization representing more than 6,300 businesses of all industries and all sizes across the state who employ more than 500,000 employees. The Chamber's, we support policies that best position our state for future success by advancing a competitive business climate to encourage a growing economy. This morning, I would like to reiterate the Chamber's opposition to certain provisions in House File 2274 that were part of the 2024 tax bill. First, we strongly oppose the sections of Article 1 that relate to the public disclosure of corporate tax returns. These sections would require the public disclosure of private taxpayer data that violates a long-standing principle of taxpayer privacy, a principle previously raised in this committee by Chair Gomez regarding recent IRS developments. This change would also make Minnesota an extreme outlier, as no other state requires similar disclosure and the federal government prohibits the release of federal taxpayer information. A better approach is for policymakers to review aggregate data already allowed under current law to better understand corporate taxes without violation of taxpayers' privacy and imposing additional negative impacts to our business climate. I'd also like to share concerns with Article 1, Section 11, which relates to Section 530 nonconformity. To restate from last year, we share the goal of preventing worker misclassification and believe repeat, willful, or deliberate misclassification should be thoroughly investigated and punished because it cheats workers and honest employers alike. The OLA report on worker misclassification from last year makes it clear that determining a worker's proper status can be challenging and subjective. That's why we oppose the removal of this longstanding safe harbor that exists at the federal level and has been followed at the state level for businesses that have acted reasonably and in good faith regarding their classification of workers. The safe harbor protects against the assessment of retroactive employment taxes, and importantly, under Section 530, businesses have criteria that they must meet around reporting, consistency, and reasonableness. In situations where an employer makes an honest mistake, education and corrective action is appropriate, and the state should continue to have a safe harbor for Minnesota businesses that have acted reasonably and in good faith. And finally, I won't repeat our concerns with the sections of Article 6 that relate to land value taxation districts, but do want to flag that those issues still remain. So appreciate your consideration of our concerns today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. Ms. Madden. Gavin Hansen, you're on deck. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Nan Madden. I'm Director of the Minnesota Budget Project. Appreciate the opportunity to testify today and particularly in support of provisions to create a direct file system which would provide Minnesotans with a free, easier, and less time-consuming option for filing their state income taxes. Direct file could also increase the number of Minnesotans who receive the tax credits or other tax benefits they currently qualify for and increase the effectiveness of outreach efforts. Paying taxes is how we come together to fund public services that Minnesotans value and count on, but with our current system, the majority of folks pay to meet their tax filing responsibilities. For example, the IRS estimates that the average non-business taxpayer spends about 8 hours and $160 to prepare for and file their federal return. Minnesotans today have limited access to free tax filing options. Only about 4% of Minnesota taxpayers file through a free tax filing option today. With current resources, these services are not available to serve all Minnesotans who are eligible, and there are income, age, and other restrictions on who can use them. Only a few private tax preparation software companies offer a free filing option in Minnesota, and these free filing options do not always end up being free, and it's not required that private options are accessible or available to all tax filers who would qualify. So a free public filing option would be a better choice for many Minnesotans, and Minnesota can build on learnings at the federal level. In 2024, the federal government piloted a free direct file tool, which was available in 12 states, and in 2025, half of U.S. states are participating in an expanded version of direct file. 90% of 2024 direct file users who responded to a survey reported that their filing experience was excellent or above average. We believe Minnesota should build on the positive federal experience, as well as planning that's already been done at the state level to work towards implementing a state level direct file program. And two other elements of this bill that I'd like to lift up. We support expanding the child tax credit to include 18-year-old dependents, and we appreciate the attention to protecting renters from the negative consequences of the Alliance housing issue related to charitable rental housing. And we look forward to future conversation on those issues.
Thank you, Ms. Madden. Gavin Hansen and Eric Bernstein, you're on deck. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself as you get started.
Chair Gomez, members of the House Tax Committee, my name is Gavin Hansen, and I'm the Fiscal and Economic Policy Director for the Minnesota Business Partnership. The MBP is comprised of more than 100 CEOs and senior executives of Minnesota's largest employers. Collectively, MBP members employ approximately 4.8 million worldwide, including nearly 500,000 here in Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to provide comments on House File 2274, specifically Article 1, Section 4, the corporate disclosure section. A bill that would require disclosure of franchise tax information. One of our primary goals at the Minnesota Business Partnership is to help make Minnesota a more competitive place to do business in a global economy. Quite simply, House File 2274 would put Minnesota companies at a significant competitive disadvantage, as no other state in the United States comes close to requiring tax disclosure. A few of our main concerns with the bill is, one, the disclosure of significant private taxpayer information. Two, the uncertainty of how that disclosed information would be used or interpreted by competitors, other states, or competitor nations, and the public. Three, the complication of disclosing your tax information without also disclosing your federal information. And four, the disclosure requirement would result in the publication of returns that are party to an audit, appeals, or litigation. The businesses targeted by House File 2274 already follow laws and regulations, endure nearly constant audits by the IRS in order to remain compliant. Necessary agencies also have the ability to gain access to tax returns if they so choose. The tools are already in place to ensure compliance. This bill would be a completely unnecessary move by the legislature. In summary, under this bill, Minnesota companies would have all their private confidential tax information made public, which would mean putting it in the hands of out-of-state or foreign competitors. Why would the Minnesota legislature want to punish homegrown Minnesota businesses and put them at a competitive disadvantage? Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Eric Bernstein, you're next. Welcome to the committee.
Chair Gomez and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Eric Bernstein, and I am director of We Make Minnesota. We're a coalition of labor and grassroots organizations united in support of public investment for a more just and equitable state. Thank you for the opportunity to share our perspective on HF, House File 2274, which proposes a number of reforms to make Minnesota's tax administration more fair, transparent, and accessible to all. In particular, our coalition enthusiastically supports provisions in this bill that would create a system of free and publicly administered tax filing, as well as provisions that would make corporate tax returns public. In Section 5, the free filing, according to the IRS, the average taxpayer spends 13 hours. It sounds like I got a different statistic than Nan Madden, but 13 hours at $270 preparing their taxes on for-profit systems that are often predatory and deceptive. Providers like TurboTax and H&R Block have been accused repeatedly of overselling services, misleading their customers, and seeking undue profit at every turn. As recently as January of 2024, the FTC ordered that Intuit remove ads promoting free tax preparation services on its TurboTax platform without stipulating who qualified for the free version of the service. That was less than a year after the same company paid $141 million to over 4 million Americans that were deceived into paying for services they were eligible to access for free. The FTC also accused H&R Block of wiping customer data when they sought to downgrade to a cheaper version of their own software, steering those customers back to a higher-priced premium service. Minnesota should protect Minnesotans from these predatory practices and relieve them of the unnecessary cost of paying to file their taxes by providing a free system that guarantees fast and accurate filing. On Section 4, we're also highly supportive of efforts to make our corporate tax code more transparent by publicly disclosing corporate tax returns. Corporate tax avoidance and base erosion are issues of international and bipartisan consensus. The International Monetary Fund, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, Nobel Prize-winning economists, and even the authors of former President Trump's tax cuts and current President Trump's Tax Cuts and Jobs Act all share concerns about our eroding corporate tax base. While corporate profits have risen to their highest level on record, effective corporate tax rates and corporate income tax revenues are declining nationally. Corporations contributed as much as 40% of federal revenues in the middle of the 20th century compared to less than 6% today. Transparency is needed now more than ever, more than it was a year ago when we heard this bill for the first time. Right now, the federal government is considering a massive 18% reduction to the IRS workforce, which has already been understaffed for decades. The impact of these cuts will be to reduce audit rates and thus increase instances of and incentives for tax evasion. In other words, a tax cut for tax dodgers that will increase the federal budget deficit and place a greater burden on law-abiding taxpayers. This will impact Minnesota's budget by reducing federal funds available for state-managed programs like Medicaid and also reduce state revenues directly by cutting the revenues we get that are collected in instances of successful federal audits that are passed on to the state, which is something we depend on substantially. Disclosure is one simple and affordable tool the state can use to discourage evasion and increase transparency and also ensure corporations are paying their fair share. I know that the business community does not like this policy, but those with nothing to hide should have nothing to fear. This disclosure is similar to that performed by nonprofits, labor unions, and publicly traded corporations. It will make our system more fair and trustworthy, and we urge you to put those admirable objectives over corporate desire for secrecy. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Bernstein. That's the end of the folks who signed up to testify. Is there anyone else present who wishes to testify on this bill? Oh, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself as you get started with your testimony.
Good morning, chairs and members of the committee. My name is Christy Snyder, and I'm the Policy and System Transformation Officer at Youth Prize. I use she, her pronouns. Youth Prize is a statewide intermediary devoted to elevating youth voice and increasing equity for young people in the state of Minnesota up to age 26. I am in support of House File 2274, but I'm focusing on the including children up to their through their 18th year to their 19th birthday for the child tax credit. The child tax credit is a key tool in supporting pathways out of poverty for children and families, and I'm excited that it is included here in this bill and also in House File 2302 that you will hear as a standalone bill on Thursday. It is nearing high school graduation season, and many people associate that with young people turning 18. But the end of adolescence varies depending on the system and how we understand brain science. K-12 funding currently goes up to age 21. This bill will support young people to get across the finish line to their high school graduation. The Youth Workforce and Innovation Act, WIOA funding, goes from 14 to 24, recognizing that young people need support to fully launch into the workforce. We also know that the Affordable Care Act currently allows young people to be on their family's insurance until the age of 26. Moving the child tax credit acknowledges that funds the family incur during their 18th year rather than simply cut them off on their 18th birthday or their 17th birthday. While we are not yet there in aligning all of our systems, this tax bill honors the funds needed through the 18th year to support a successful launch to adulthood. I would be remiss not to note that young adults of middle and upper incomes receive significant sums of financial assistance through their 18th year and beyond, but largely informally and inequitably. A Merrill Lynch analysis found that American parents collectively give their young adult children, $500 billion a year in financial assistance. Yet research shows large racial and ethnic disparities in parental financial transfers due to structural inequities in the form of economic resources, family structure, and health. I invite us all to sit with this. It has become more expensive to launch into adulthood, and we keep the true costs hidden. This tax bill is supporting more equitable practices and supporting healthy and successful launch into adulthood. And while my focus is on expanding the child tax credit through the 18th year, I would be remiss not noting the intersections with the local aid for homelessness. As we work with young people, we do see the intersection of those young people experiencing homelessness that benefit from the local aid, and I'm grateful to see the fund can extend beyond the currently slotted 2028 sunset. This fund currently supports young people to ensure housing instability is brief, rare, and non-reoccurring. Thank you, Chair Gomez, for aligning this source of funding with other critical local aid by removing the sunset. Extending the K-12 or the child tax credit to age 18 will not transform our system and the culture that we need to still do, but it is the next right step. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Snyder. You did sign up, but I had you canceled, so my apologies for that. Looks like Mr. Carlson's approaching. Welcome to the committee. I was surprised to see you not pre-file, so it's great to see you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself as you get started with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I represent online travel agents and have for a long time. And this is now my 16th year of opposition to Article 5, Section 1 and 2. It is not a tax avoidance. I know I have been in before you many, many times. All the taxes paid on what a consumer pays. All the local lodging taxes paid on what a consumer pays for the room. This is a tax on their service fee, which we do not think we can viably be a local taxpayer in 130 different jurisdictions at different rates for an online company. The tax mechanism for complying with this by having a local jurisdiction send a letter to one taxpayer but not another is fraught with problems. And I apologize for missing the notice to sign up in advance, but I again have to at least register the opposition to this tax increase. We would pay more tax to the city of Bloomington than we pay to the state for sales tax on our service fees. That's how high their local lodging tax is. And appreciate your consideration, Madam Chair. I know we have a polite disagreement about this one.
Indeed we do, but you're always welcome here, whether you sign up beforehand or not, as you know.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Chair Davids.
If Mr. Carlson is on his 16th year fighting this, he must be pretty good.
I reckon so, Mr. Chair. Maybe we'll just keep it going. I mean, why not 20? Let's see what we can do. So there are, I believe that concludes the testimony, unless there's anybody else present who wants to offer any words about House File 2274. All right, I'm not seeing any. I will just direct members to some letters that are in your packet. Not everybody who had something to say about the bill testified in person, but there is other information there. All right, so moving on to member discussion. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. I have a question, I guess, going back to Article 1, Section 4. I was just reading on this and trying to get caught up on it. There's a little bit of difference between the memorandum, House Research Memorandum, what they said domestic sales, and I was trying to look in the section here to see whether it said domestic in there. Maybe I didn't read it in there, but I guess I have a question regarding this. Now, is domestic sales specifically having to deal with sales in the state of Minnesota?
I see Mr. Clayman's coming up. So a lot of the companies that would be covered by this have sales in multiple states, and so this was the domestic sales, so it, not just in Minnesota, but in all states. And Mr. Clayman, I don't know if you have, if I said that right, or if you have anything to add.
Madam Chair and members, yes, that's correct. So the reference to domestic sales just indicates how the current corporate franchise tax system works. So it stops at the water's edge of the United States. And so the aggregate amount of sales that's in the underlying bill refers to the total domestic sales of that particular corporation or group of corporations.
Thank you, Mr. Clayman. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. Follow-up question, does this only apply to companies that are domicile in Minnesota or incorporate in Minnesota?
Mr. Clayman.
Madam Chair and Representative Johnson, no. So it would apply to any corporation that would have a tax liability in Minnesota, so it could have their corporate headquarters in another state, but they're making sales into the state, which subjects them to the corporate franchise tax.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. Continuing on that line of questioning, what about if it's an international company that is doing sales in the state of Minnesota? Are you going to expect them to also comply?
Mr. Klayman?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, if they're subject to the state corporate franchise tax, so if there's a foreign corporation would not be subject to the corporate franchise tax, but if they have like subsidiary, they have some sort of nexus with the, or if they have some sort of like subsidiary in the United States, and that would allow Minnesota then to subject them to the corporate franchise tax, then they would be included.
Thank you. So then the subsidiary would have to have $250 million of gross domestic sales, and there would have to be nexus. In other words, they would have to be operating in Minnesota and have subject to the corporate franchise tax in Minnesota. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. So if I understand correctly, this would incentivize businesses that say Minnesota is a smaller part of their sales. I mean, the incentive would be for businesses to move out of Minnesota to avoid this reporting, since no other state requires this.
I think I'll take that one. I don't think that's exactly a technical question. If a company moved their headquarters out of Minnesota and they still had Nexus in Minnesota, they would still be subject to this if they met the $250 million gross domestic sales threshold. And so I think it would be difficult to make the case that this incentivizes anybody to move their headquarters out of Minnesota, because the question, as Mr. Klayman pointed out, is not whether a corporation is domiciled in Minnesota. It's about whether they have nexus and whether they have tax liability, corporate income tax liability in Minnesota. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. So basically what I'm hearing, that if a company located in North Dakota had $10,000 in sales in Minnesota, and the bulk of their sales were the rest of the country, Minnesota would still expect them to put their tax returns on file. Is that correct?
I guess I'll point that one to Mr. Klayman, because I don't remember if we put a threshold in here for the Minnesota sales. I do know we did the $25 million nationally, but Mr. Klayman?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, so it would be in the scenario that you describe, if a corporation only had $10,000 in Minnesota sales, but they hit the $250 million aggregate domestic sales threshold, then this would still apply, the disclosure requirement would still apply to that corporation. And I also misspoke, Madam Chair and members, it would not be based on tax liability, but a return requirement. So if a corporation had a return
right.
obligation, so. Yeah.
Okay.
But that's, yeah.
Representative Johnson.
Just thanks, Chair Gomez. I just want to put in my head again that a company that had a minor presence here but decided to do some business in Minnesota, any amount of sales that would put Nexus in here, that company would have to have some serious discussions with their shareholders and company owners whether Minnesota was worth having business at all or a place to grow business in. Correct?
I think that's a statement, Representative Johnson.
Well, it's,
I mean, it's not a question for nonpartisans, so, okay. But it sounds like a statement to me.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Is there any further questions, discussions? Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just as of yesterday, co-chair of the Elections Committee, I became a real boy at 3:30 and got voting privileges on the committee restored. I just feel obligated to mention a good provision in this bill. It's starting on line 2.24. It has bipartisan support. It's Representative Bonner's provision for the Political Contribution Refund Modernization Act. It just might be of interest to the candidates at this table. I know this is something we've all dealt with as candidates and legislators. So, asking people to fill out the form to mail it in, to get it returned to the Department of Revenue to get a refund on a contribution to a state candidate. This would enable them to do that process electronically. I know Representative Bonner has worked really hard on this provision. I think she's presenting it in judiciary potentially as we speak, and we heard the substance of it in elections as well. So just glad to see this in here, glad to see it getting a hearing, and wanted to call that out. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Freiberg. Chair Joachim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Freiberg, I too am excited about that bill. I have some family members that are excited about that bill. But going back to Article 1, and I'm trying to remember the hearing that we had on this, but just to clarify so I understand, in the corporate franchise tax, if a corporation, they'd have to hit the threshold of $250 million in domestic sales?
Yeah, that's correct, Chair.
Okay, so not just a few thousand here or there.
Yes.
Madam Chair, I have a quick follow-up question.
Yes, Representative Joachim, go ahead.
Maybe for nonpartisan staff, too. I'm trying to remember this because I have a child that works virtually, but he's making that income. He's paid through Minnesota, though. But, like, people that have are working in another state and live in another, maybe they are contractors and they work across the country. A lot of our construction workers do that. If they're making money in another state as income, they have to pay that state tax. Is that accurate? Can anybody?
Yeah, Mr. Williams.
Chair Gomez and Representative Joachim, it sort of varies state to state what the filing requirement is. Certain states have different numbers of days worked in that state if you're working in multiple different places. In Minnesota, sort of ours is tied basically to the standard deduction amount. So you have a filing requirement in Minnesota if your Minnesota source income is above the standard deduction amount for single filers, if that makes sense.
Representative Joachim?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Williams. So kind of like a threshold, right, for making an income in another state. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Davids? Okay. Is there any further discussion or questions? Representative Anderson.
I have a process question.
Yeah.
For the two chairs. So my understanding is that when we do a bill as a tax bill, that there's nothing that's going to be in there unless it's bipartisan. Am I correct in my understanding?
Representative Anderson, I mean, that's effectively what we're looking at, yeah, is basically Chair Davids and I, and in consultation with the committee, will be moving forward a House position that will be negotiated, and so... so we kind of have to agree on what we put forward and what we send out into the world.
Okay.
Representative Anderson.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. Well, it's probably going to be a small bill this year, but that's okay. So,
Chair Davids. Well, regardless of its size, its glory will not be questioned, I think.
Okay.
Thank you.
I just want to just make sure we understand the process as we're looking at all these different things. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Us hearing this bill, of course, is sort of the beginning of the conversation, not the end. Surely not every provision in this bill, regardless of what I want, will make it over the line. But we'll be moving forward. But these items that are part of 2274 are sort of in the mix as we put forward our bill. The House position. So thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Is there any further discussion, questions? All right. Chair Davids. Okay. Thank you. All right. Seeing no further discussion, I will renew my motion that House File 2274 is laid over for possible inclusion in the House tax bill, and it is laid over. Next up is House File 1932. This is another Gomez bill. I'm going to move that House File 1932 be laid over for possible inclusion in the House tax bill. So House File 1932 is funds tax assistance and tax credit outreach grants. These are sort of two of the ways that the Department of Revenue supports low-income taxpayers to prepare their returns and to promote the availability of tax credits. So the first is taxpayer assistance grants, and those go to to VITA sites. So these are federally kind of defined and funded sites that help lower income Minnesotans file their taxes. It's $1 million a year to taxpayer assistance grants, and then $1 million a year to tax credit outreach grants, which is this other pot of money that is used to publicize and promote the availability of tax credits for low-income taxpayers in particular, including the education credit, renter's credit, child credit, working family credit, homestead, property tax refunds, and that kind of thing. So I'm going to move that the bill is be laid over, and we have a couple testifiers before we get to member discussion. First up, Dr. Alvin Akibar from Prepare and Prosper. Welcome to the committee. Please just introduce yourself once you get up there and proceed with your testimony. Oh, Mr. Gregg, if you want to go up there too, you're next. You're on deck. They're from the same organization, so it's okay if they sit next to each other, right? We want to have a redo of Gavin.
Thank you, Chair Gomez, members of the Tax Committee. My name is Dr. Alvin Akibar. I am Assistant Exchange Director at Prepare and Prosper here in St. Paul, Minnesota. I am thankful to be here to testify in support of House File 1932 for both taxpayer assistance and tax credit outreach. Prepare and Prosper is the largest VITA provider in the state of Minnesota, providing just over half of VITA filings for Minnesotans, providing or bringing back nearly $22 million into our community year over year. Our median income for our customers is about $19,000 a year, and keep that in mind in a state where the cost of living is roughly $90,000 for a single person to live comfortably. So for a lot of these folks, this is more than 40% of their income coming back to them in their return with these credits. These assistance grants have been monumental in being able to expand our services to folks who may not have the resources to pay for tax filings, who may not have the bandwidth to be able to file by themselves. And so that includes our seniors, folks who are living in nursing homes and care facilities, and folks who may be small businesses or self-employed who might not be able to afford or understand a lot of the records keeping that's necessary to not be messed over in their self-employment filings. So a lot of our services are going out to our communities, being provided by community, and doing so in a way that is clear, accessible, and really tries to remove a lot of the fear from this filing element. In addition, these outreach grants have been really, really helpful in reaching beyond the metro, being able to educate folks outstate around what's going on with the tax credits, the importance of filing and getting current on their taxes, and again, demystifying a lot of these credits. There's been a lot of confusion around whether the federal or the state child tax credit applies one way or the other. And so being able to have clear, simple messaging from a trusted source has been extremely helpful in making sure that folks know what's coming to them, what they need to do, and know where they can go to get this information. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Akibar, for your testimony. Willie Gregg, please introduce yourself as you get started.
Thank you, Chairs, members of the committee. My name is Willie Gregg, Senior Tax and Financial Services Manager at Prepare and Prosper here in St. Paul. Like Dr. Akibar said, we are one of many sites that exist across the state in all different corners and parts of the state. So there are over 150 free tax prep sites across the state. And in 2023, the VITA community as a whole served about over 50,000 people and returned around $100 million in refunds to hardworking Minnesotans in various places. You know, we help individuals, families, seniors, persons with disabilities, entrepreneurs, and many more. And just to clarify that, this is for both VITA and TCE sites that include AARP, so services focused on seniors and the elderly, as well as sites that exist in urban areas, rural areas, all over in any place. Running a VITA site is burdensome and costly in terms of recruiting and training volunteers, procuring technology sites, everything, and there's ups and downs in terms of people being able to continue with this work or not every year. And so this funding will help ensure and stabilize things, especially with a unstable, we'll say, federal funding landscape at this point in time, in terms of maintaining and continuing the strong and strong services that we provide to the community. You know, people rely on and really focus in on being able to go to a trusted partner with their tax preparation process and that is Prepare and Prosper, and that is these sites that exist all across the state. And so we are able to provide those services as well as outreach to help prepare families, prepare people for what they need to do, all the steps they need to take to not just who needs to file, but also what do you need to be taking advantage of or doing and putting together in order to take advantage of all the credits that are available to people. One example of an underutilized credit is something like the K-12 credit that is for qualified education expenses that a lot of families don't realize exist and could be taken more advantage of going forward. So we are in strong support of this funding and continued funding to help make sure to maintain, expand, and strengthen the services that we provide and other places provide as well.
Thank you, Mr. Gregg. If you guys could just hold on a sec. Representative Robbins, did you have a question for these testifiers? Great, please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for coming. I have concerns specifically about the education tax credit outreach you just described. So as you know, there was an article in the Sahan Journal this year outlining how people had done outreach to sign people up for this, and then they didn't get the services or got not the services they expected, but in some cases did not get the services, and they had assigned their education tax credit over to one of these third-party groups or multiple. And then not only did they get the amount of the education credit they were supposed to get, but that encumbered their entire taxpayer refund.
Yeah.
And so I'm kind of stunned that you're advocating for that here before this committee. Yeah. I know the governor has talked about proposal to make sure that those middlemen are no longer allowed to get assigned the tax credit, and I'm looking forward to seeing that language. But this was a huge problem, and it's one of the reasons I have concerns about this. So in the language of the bill, Madam Chair, it talks about referencing 27C.21, and I looked that up, and it says one or more providers. And there's no language in this bill or in the underlying statute that talks about a competitive award process. So I think as we move forward, that's something we need to fix because this has been a not successful program and many people were harmed by it. Thank you.
So we're going to go to Dr. Akibar for a comment. I just would say that we absolutely share your deep concern about the assignment kind of portion of the K-12 education credit. It's a really small number of them, but one is too many. And, you know, as you know, the governor is proposing language basically, you know, pulling back that part of the design of the credit because it opens itself up to misuse and abuse of, let's just be really clear, this is misuse and abuse of the lowest income taxpayers who are trying to provide education for their family in good faith and get them the tutoring and support that they need. And so, you know, we talked about the K-12 credit in general, right? If you don't do the assignment process, doesn't have the same design issues. But, you know, we very much share those concerns. I know that Representative Norris has worked a lot on this, and I'm going to go to Dr. Akibar for anything you would like to provide. Thank you.
Yes, I want to thank you very much for your concerns, Representative Robbins. We are also deeply troubled by the following the stories and trying to understand what happened, how it happened, and why. So I want to clarify, we kind of occupy different lanes in the enrollers for this K-12 credit. We help folks file their taxes. We are not necessarily in the after-school service provision market, which seems to be where a lot of this fraud was occurring. But for a lot of our customers, we are the folks who help them clean that up. Trying to help them understand what happened with their taxes, going through the process with them. We have our amazing employee, Carol, who's kind of our, you know, break glass in case of something strange happening and helping talk folks through these deeply complicated and frustrating and troubling areas, figuring out how to make current with the IRS, setting up payment plans, making it possible for folks not to feel like they're alone in this process. VITA is not, you know, we are not in the market of trying to sell anyone anything. And again, we occupy a different lane than these folks. The ability to have outreach and make sure that folks are getting good information has been crucial. The ability to, right now our focus has been on the child tax credit and helping folks know that they need to file. The ability to actually demystify, debunk, and do some kind of scam prevention and consumer protection around this would be amazing. But right now, I think the funding landscape was just increased to help cover some of the changes to the recent child tax credit and now to the renter's credit. I would really appreciate action from this body to ensure that more of our customer base are protected from this.
Thank you. And Mr. Williams, did you have anything you wanted to contribute, or you're good? Okay, thank you. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate your support in cleaning this up, and I look forward to the governor's language. And I would just encourage everyone that we add language in making sure these grants are competitive. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Robbins, for bringing up this point. I was wondering if we could possibly hear from the department to clarify just exactly what the governor wants to do.
Thank you. Ms. Bears is coming up.
I think I'm supporting the governor. I didn't see that a lot. We're not on tape, though.
It's just between us, Mr. Chair.
Okay, good.
Okay. Ms. Bears, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joanna Bears. I'm the legislative director at the Department of Revenue. And Madam Chair, Representative Davids, the governor is planning to repeal the assignment portion of the K-12 credit. The K-12 credit will be the same, but we're just not allowing the assignment piece.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Davids. Are there any further questions? Oh, Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I wanted to go back to the bill text and a question that Representative Robbins raised, and I'm wondering if Mr. Williams can help answer this question. So I think if you look at so there's a Section A and B. Section A is for taxpayer assistance grants, and then Section B is for outreach grants. And so I wanted to just clarify. It seems like Section A is the grants that would go towards funding VITA sites, which are already federally defined. Mr. Williams, is that correct?
Mr. Williams?
Chair Gomez and Representative Lee. So there's sort of two programs. I think the way I think of it is that the taxpayer assistance grants are just for tax preparation services. So VITA sites is what people call them. That's sort of the federal designation for them. So those funds the taxpayer assistance money has to be used by a site that's approved under federal law to provide taxpayer assistance services. The tax credit outreach grants can be used both for those tax preparation services and also for promoting the availability of tax credits. So that I think that one way to think of it is that the taxpayer assistance grants are sort of a subset of the tax credit outreach grants. That makes sense.
Thank you. Representative Lee.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Williams. So that's really helpful, and that's why there's no competitive portion to Section A. And then I guess for Section B, I don't know if this is a question for Mr. Williams or Ms. Bears. Can you tell us who typically gets these grants? I know you said so this can be used for taxpayer assistance as well, so it seems like it can also go to the VITA sites.
Mr. Williams?
Chair Gomez and Representative Lee, I have a list of data. I think that through both programs, it's not provided to just one organization. So my understanding, and Ms. Bears maybe can comment, but I think the department publishes a request for a proposal, and there is a competitive grant process for both of these programs. And it's more than 15 or 20 sites for both, I think.
Thank you. Ms. Bears, just can you clarify for the committee whether this the allocations under these two buckets go to competitive grants or direct appropriations?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I don't know if I'm still on the record or not, but I'm good. Okay. These allocations go with, people do an RFP process, so they do bid for these amounts. We review them, and we try to get as many organizations to ask for them, but we do try to give a little bit of money to each organization that qualifies. But it is competitive because they have to apply through the grant proposal process.
Thank you, Ms. Bears. If you could just stay with us for a moment. Representative Robbins, do you have anything further?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. So just to be clear, in the bill, it references Section 270C.21, subdivisions 3 and 4, and that language does say, as I referenced earlier, The commissioner must make grants to one or more volunteer assistance organizations. So I just think we could clean that up by saying competitive grant process, because right now they have the ability to give it all to one, and with great respect for our friend Commissioner Marquardt, he won't always be the commissioner, so I just think getting competitive processes and statute whenever possible is good governance. Good government all the time, Mr. Chair.
All right. I mean, I think that's a great suggestion, and so I appreciate you for making it. And this bill is going to be laid over, so, you know, if this does end up, you know, being something that we can do within our budget, I am very open to clarifying the current reality, which is that this is a competitive grant process, that these organizations are vetted by the Department of Revenue, and, you know, that it's not a, it's not like a intended in any way to be like a direct appropriation to one site over others. Representative Lee.
Okay, and then just to close out, because I want to make sure there's no ambiguity, because there's been a lot of, like, you know, questions. In case people are wondering, these grants are for tax preparers. It's not for whatever unscrupulous people were taking advantage of tax credits, which happens really often. And this is why we, when we do issue tax credits, right, we ask for the receipts, right? And this typically, we like to use a reimbursement model at the Department of Revenue. And so I just want to make that very clear that the folks before us today are doing really good work. And at a time when, you know, congressional Republicans are trying to get rid of our direct tax file program on the federal level, this money is actually really important to seniors and people who are limited income who want to file their taxes and you know, want to pay their fair share. They need this help, and this is why I'm thankful for the bill. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Lee. Is there any further discussion or questions, rather, for either of the testifiers or Ms. Bears? Okay, you are free. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much. We do have one further testifier who's testifying remotely. Michelle Jensen. This is our first time doing this, so, you know, hopefully we'll be able to hear Michelle.
Good morning. Are you able to hear me?
We can. Please proceed with your testimony. If you wouldn't mind identifying yourself for the record first.
Of course. My name is Michelle Jensen, and I'm the Family Services and Tax Program Manager for United Community Action Partnership. And thank you for the opportunity to be here today. For the past 19 tax seasons, United Community Action has operated the VITA program and provided free tax preparation services to low-income taxpayers in 13 counties in southwest Minnesota. The impact of the additional funding through the Minnesota Taxpayer Assistance and Tax Credit Outreach Grants has ensured that our agency meets the one-to-one match requirement to accept federal grant funds for the VITA program, and has even more importantly enabled us to expand services in southwest Minnesota. This year, our agency added two new tax sites to the existing six we already operate, allowing greater access to our program in rural areas. These grants have allowed United Community Action to bring on two additional staff and recruit and train 39 new volunteers, which has made it possible to expand our capacity as well as meet the growing needs of free tax preparation services. We've also increased services to the elderly, persons with disabilities, underserved populations, and households with limited English proficiency. Leveraging the skills of our tax volunteers, last year, United Community Action served just over 2,700 low-income individuals in Greater Minnesota, returning more than $6 million in federal and state tax refunds. By providing outreach and education on Minnesota tax credits, we've been able to reach many more low-income taxpayers, and in the past year saw a 55% increase in new households seeking our services. Many of these new taxpayers had not previously claimed credits they were eligible for, such as the Working Family Credit. The impact of this program is immense. As the cost for basic needs like rent and utilities, groceries and such rise, for those who are already struggling, paying $200 to $500 to file their taxes is an undue burden. When taxpayers are asked through an anonymous survey about how they will use the money saved on tax preparation fees, as well as their tax refunds, the overwhelming majority respond that they will use it for basic needs, housing, food, utilities, healthcare, car repairs, and gas to get back and forth to work or to look for work. And most of the tax refunds claimed are spent in the taxpayers' local communities, which is really important. Free tax preparation clinics help people feed their families and remain housed rather than become homeless. Helping taxpayers claim all the credits they're eligible for can help them stay warm because they can keep up with their utility bills. The services can keep people working because they can put gas in or repair their vehicle, which is crucial in greater Minnesota due to the lack of public transportation options. As a community action agency with a focus on fighting poverty, we see every day how these high-impact programs help the people we serve, but also the economies of the communities we live in. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much, Ms. Jensen. That concludes the testifiers that I had signed up. Is there anyone else present who wishes to testify on House File 1932? Not seeing any, we can move to member discussion. Not seeing anything further. I'll just offer a few comments, if that's okay. So, you know, I think that our testifiers from Prepare and Prosper were a little humble about their contribution to this work. So these VITA sites that, as we heard, there's 153 of them across the state. They are critical. We heard Ms. Jensen talk about how many of their clients are eligible for these tax credits and are not. They're not applying for them, even when that money would really help them. And it's really just about access and information. And so this is really designed to bridge that access and information gap that lower income people have. I was had the privilege of visiting with a VITA site in Mahnomen County a couple years back. You know, Prepare and Prosper, this is what they do. They do tax preparation. A lot of the agencies that are doing this work across the state, including these CAP agencies, if you guys have CAP agencies in your districts, you know that they do so many different things. They don't just do tax preparation. They do all kinds of anti-poverty programming. And so they kind of have to like stand these sites up each year. The federal dollars that they get are really, really small compared to the impact that they have and very restrictive. And so, you know, some of these agencies in greater Minnesota rely on Prepare and Prosper to help provide them with technical assistance for standing up a new site, for figuring out how to make these services work across the state. And so, you know, Prepare and Prosper, they prepare 50% of the tax returns that VITA sites prepare, but they also are a statewide resource to other agencies doing this work. And I don't want to like share something I'm not supposed to, but you know, they're funded through federal dollars, as we said. And when the Trump-Musk administration decided that they were going to freeze all federal dollars in those first few days, when there was the memo from the Office of Management and Budget, I think, or maybe it was another federal agency, Prepare and Prosper had already completed work for the previous quarter, and their funding was frozen. So they're in the middle of tax season. This is February, right? Tax documents are due at the end of January. So they're in the middle of their busiest season. I mean, if you go to Prepare and Prosper, just go hang out there. They would be happy to have you. And you can talk to some of the people who come through. I mean, we really are talking about, you know, the median of $19,000 a year. Think about what it is to live on that. We're talking seniors, people with disabilities, vulnerable people, working families across our state who are getting these services. And they were looking, because of the freeze on federal funds, Prepare and Prosper in the middle of tax prep season was like, we can't continue operating in 2.5 weeks. That was what the director Miranda is here. I see you've joined us. So, you know, Suyapa Miranda is the executive director of Prepare and Prosper. And she was having to sit there in her busiest season and say, how am I going to make payroll in 2 weeks? Because the money that is supposed to be coming from the federal government is not coming. And so because we had established the taxpayer assistance grants at the state level in last year's bill, we were able to contact the Department of Revenue. They had already made their determination. They'd already had their competitive process, and Prepare and Prosper had was set to receive a grant from the taxpayer assistance. And we were able to connect with the Department of Revenue, and they expedited that those dollars getting to Prepare and Prosper so that they didn't have to shut down in February. So I just, you know, we really, in the context especially of, you know, really critical services that are supported by federal dollars and this uncertainty, it's important that we step up and we, you know, support these efforts that are happening in our communities and that are just helping people get access to, you know, the credits that they need, the you know, dollars. We heard from Ms. Jensen and the folks who from Prepare and Prosper hear exactly the same thing. What are people gonna spend these returns on? And what are people gonna spend their savings on for not having to go pay that $200 to $500 to H&R Block or whatever? They're gonna spend it on rent, fixing their car, food for their kids, a new pair of shoes. Low-income families rely on their income tax returns to meet the basic needs of their kids. And so I appreciate, sorry for going on a little bit at the end, but I just really, you know, am obviously passionate about the work that these organizations do. And please, you all have one in your district. Please go talk to them and ask them how much money they get from the feds and what they're able to do with it, because it's really amazing what these VITA sites can do. They rely on volunteers. They rely on kind of making stuff work in really limited and difficult circumstances. So thank you. Is there any further discussion on this bill? All right, hearing none, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 1932 be laid over for possible inclusion in the tax bill, and it is laid over. All right, that concludes our business. Our next hearing is Wednesday, March 19th. Tomorrow, Chair Davids will have the gavel. I think we're hearing ag-related bills. On Thursday, I'll have the gavel, and we'll be digging into some enhancements to the child tax credit and property tax relief for Minnesotans. And with that, we are adjourned.